You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with a debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including a ballot measure about new housing in Eureka, complaints about how the city of Grants Pass is treating homeless disabled residents, and a trial of a Klamath Falls man accused of kidnapping. I'm Roma Battaglia, science, environment, and politics reporter.
I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
And I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
Justin, you had a feature this week about a ballot measure in Humboldt County. Measure F is going to voters next month. Can you tell us what this measure is all about?
Yeah, so it's called the Housing for All and Downtown Vitality Initiative, at least by supporters. And it puts requirements or really restrictions on a Eureka City plan to provide more affordable housing. And on its face, it wants to keep parking available if the city builds affordable housing on these parking lots downtown. And so just some background, because it gets a bit complicated. Around every decade, California requires cities to provide a plan to build a certain number of low-income housing units. And Eureka was tasked with creating nearly 400 affordable homes by 2027. And so they created this plan, this idea, and that was to build affordable housing on 14 parking lots, just right in the heart of downtown. Of course, if they do that, then people can't use that parking when they go to shop or work downtown. And one part of Measure F is a requirement that says that if the city builds housing there, they need to also build parking spaces to make up for what's lost and then also what new residents might need. And, you know, and that could look like the form of a, you know, ground level garage or something like that.
Yeah, interesting. So this might throw a wrench in the city's plans to build affordable housing. What do those against Measure F have to say about it?
They say that that requirement to also build parking makes the city's plan impossible. So these are low-income housing developments. Cost is a very important factor, and this measure will make the project cost prohibitive, at least according to opponents to Measure F. And that would be the point of the measure, to keep those parking lots downtown, or at least not build low-income housing on those spots. They also bring up that if Eureka doesn't build those 400 affordable housing units, it will be out of compliance with state law, and the city could face fines and lose grant money.
Interesting. In your story, you mentioned a company, Security National Properties, that has contributed a lot of money to Measure F. Can you tell us about this company's role in this campaign?
Yeah, Security National is a real estate firm. They're a major employer in Eureka, and they use the downtown parking, which the city wants to build on. That company is owned by a guy named Rob Arkley. He's a semi-local millionaire, and he has a history of contributing to lots of cultural things in Eureka, like the Art Center, which his name's on, and the zoo. But he's also kicked up controversy over the years. He opposed a city plan to return land to a local tribe. He even floated the idea of buying that land himself. And he was a character in a Supreme Court ethics scandal involving Justice Samuel Alito. There was this investigation by ProPublica that reported Alito stayed for free at Arkley's luxury fishing lodge in Alaska. And as of this week, his company has given nearly $1.5 million to the Measure F campaign. And that's a huge amount. Eureka only has around 25,000 residents. So this makes it the most expensive ballot measure campaign in Humboldt County's history.
Wow. You mentioned in the story that there's another aspect of this campaign other than the parking. What's that?
Right. So it's not just about parking is what I figured out. People are also concerned about putting specifically low-income housing downtown and how that'll change the character of the place. So Eureka's downtown does have character. It has a lot of these old Victorian-style homes and buildings and boutique shops, things that tourists like to frequent. And some Measure F supporters think that having the low-income housing amid all that will change the place. So that's the other component of the measure. It rezones an area on the other side of the city so developers can put in high density residential units there. And that other side of Eureka already has subsidized housing. It looks a bit rougher. My impression was that some kind of want to keep the low-income residents over there, away from the sort of nice downtown area.
Interesting. You spent some time in Eureka to report on this story. You drove around with a co-sponsor of Measure F, and you got a look at these, you know, very valuable parking lots. Did you get a sense of what locals think about this measure?
Yeah. So it seemed like many people know about the measure, and many people know about Arkley and his role in the campaign. Local press has covered this pretty extensively. And I got the sense that it's just more a more complicated issue than just whether the city should build low-income housing and should the city have these parking lots and be so car-centric. Most people agree that the city needs housing. Measure F supporters think that too. There's a sizable homeless population in Eureka. But there's also just real concern about what the downtown will look like with these new developments. And people don't really build like they used to in California anymore, and especially when it's low-income housing. So I got the sense that there's valid concern about how the city will change, and it's not just about hating poor people.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Justin. Jane, you wrote a story this week about complaints against the city of Grants Pass from a disability rights group. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so that's from Disability Rights Oregon, which is an advocacy group that's based in Portland, and they're basically complaining about how disabled homeless residents are being treated in the city of Grants Pass. So they've sent two letters to city officials. The most recent one was last week. The other one, I believe, was in mid-September. And so basically the city has these two temporary campsites, city-owned, you know, plots of land for homeless people to camp on. But the rule is that they have to move back and forth from one site to the other at least every week, bringing all their stuff with them, or they would face a potential $50 fine and citation, potentially an arrest. And so Disability Rights Oregon says some people can't physically do that. There are homeless people living there that are in wheelchairs or have amputations or complex health problems that make it difficult or impossible for them to carry all their stuff, you know, a mile down the road and move to a different site every week. And so they say that these people need reasonable accommodations as required by the Americans with Disabilities Act. And so basically Disability Rights Oregon is saying that Grants Pass is violating state and federal law because of how it's treating these disabled homeless people. And so I talked to this guy, Dr. Bruce Murray, and he's the chief medical officer for this nonprofit Mint, which provides homeless services in Josephine County. And Dr. Murray says that he's written 25 medical notes, medical letters for homeless residents living in these camps who he says shouldn't be moved. They're medically fragile. They've got kidney failure, heart failure, whatever it is, and they shouldn't have to move back and forth every week. So he's written them these notes, and then he claims that police have just been ignoring those letters and people are still being cited. So the goal from Dr. Murray's point of view and Disability Rights Oregon's point of view is they would rather have these medically fragile, disabled, homeless people be able to stay just at one campsite and not have to move back and forth every week. So they're trying to hopefully work with the city to find an answer to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so for those who don't know, why does the city just have these two campsites in the first place?
So basically they're following an Oregon state law, or this is their answer to try to follow an Oregon state law. So as we know, back in June, the U.S. Supreme Court sided with the city. They had this long legal battle about homelessness, but the Supreme Court sided with Grants Pass and upheld its ban on public camping. But Grants Pass still has to comply with an Oregon state law, which says that rules regulating where homeless people can camp have to be objectively reasonable, in quotes, and that term is not really defined. And so the city came up with these two campsites. So there's a place for homeless people to go. They're allowed to go there. And that's, you know, the spot that the city has designated for them. And in recent weeks, the Grants Pass City Council has been changing. They've changed the locations of some of the campsites and how long residents are able to remain there. They actually made it longer. So right now it's maximum a week before you get cited, and it was shorter before. So the two current campsites, one of them is on Southeast J Street. It's kind of an industrial part of town, and it's going to be the future water treatment plant site for the city. So that's sort of another problem with these campsites is it's temporary. That site is going to be dug up next year and won't exist anymore. And then the other site is about a quarter of an acre, and it's next to the police station. And so the city has gotten some pushback also about the quality of these sites. You know, when people were first moving in, there was no shade and no potable water there. It was quite hot. So nonprofits have been providing some of that, you know, bottled water and shade canopies now. And also there's been some pushback about the size of the lot. So the one bigger site at J Street is about 1.25 acres. And then, as I said, the one next to the police station is only about a quarter of an acre. So some people have asked questions about physically, literally, how are you expecting the same number of people if they have to move back and forth every week might not fit on that quarter acre site.
Yeah, that doesn't really make sense if you're moving from the larger site to the smaller site. How is everyone going to fit there? Plus the quality issues and obviously the disabled homeless residents. So how has the city responded then to these complaints from Disability Rights Oregon?
As far as I know, Disability Rights Oregon says they haven't received a full response yet. They say that the city attorney in Grants Pass did call them, but he wouldn't really get into a discussion about it or really talk about anything with them. I did reach out to the city attorney and the police chief, and they didn't respond to my questions. I did get a statement from the mayor, Sarah Bristol, who basically said that these sites are not intended to provide for indefinite camping, and also that she is going to hopefully continue to support efforts to make a longer-term shelter plan for people that's not these campsites. So we'll have to see. I mean, Disability Rights Oregon, they really said they would like to work with the city, but he also said he could be, you know, filing stuff in court if he wanted to. So we'll have to see if the city responds and what happens next.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Jane. Justin, you also went to the kidnapping trial of Negasi Zuberi this week. Can you tell us about the case?
Yeah, so this is a pretty wild and very disturbing case that was covered a lot when it broke last year. Zuberi is accused of kidnapping and sexually assaulting two women. In one of those cases, he's accused of taking a woman from Seattle and locking her in a makeshift concrete cell in his garage in Klamath Falls. And he rented that home, actually, from the mayor of Klamath Falls, just to make the story stranger. So this week, I went to the U.S. District Court in Medford, and I heard testimony from that Seattle woman. She was 21 when she says Zuberi took her, and she says she was working as a commercial sex worker in Seattle at the time. And so this is kind of what she alleges. Basically, Zuberi picked her up, he paid for sex, and then spun this strange tale about him being an undercover officer. He said he was on a sting operation. He handcuffed her, shackled her ankles. He threatened her with a taser and a handgun. He raped her and drove her all the way to Klamath Falls to imprison her.
Wow. And so prosecutors brought in some evidence during the trial. Can you tell us what you saw?
Yeah, there was one point when prosecutors brought in this big black metal door that has these bars on it, which they say they recovered from Zuberi's garage. And the witness showed the court how she broke through this metal, this door to escape. And she basically broke through the metal screen at first in the door when Zuberi left her alone. To do that, she had to bite off her fingernails to do that. She had these long acrylic nails. And she was small enough at the time to slip through the bars. So that's how she got out of this cell. She cut herself while she was escaping through that door, and the DNA evidence on the door will be part of the prosecutor's case. You know, she says she got out of that small room. This is when Zuberi left her alone. She grabbed Zuberi's handgun, which she remembered that he had shown her from his car. And she told prosecutors that she was ready to use that handgun on him if he confronted her. But that didn't happen. She was able to get outside, where she flagged down a motorist and eventually called the police.
Wow. And so what does Zuberi's defense have to say about these allegations?
In their opening statements, they basically said that the state was relying too much off accusations from these women, and they questioned whether the state had evidence for all these accusations. In the coming weeks, juries will be seeing a lot of the evidence. The trial is expected to last around 3 weeks, and the state is going to call dozens of witnesses, have hundreds of exhibits. So we'll be heading back to the courtroom to hear more testimony at some point as this trial unfolds.
Great. Well, we're looking forward to more coverage of this trial from you, Justin. Jane, really quickly, you know, you reported on the groundbreaking of this new micro shelter in Reading. First, what is a micro shelter?
They're calling it a micro shelter. Yeah, so it is 17 basically little buildings. So they're 64 to 100 square feet, and they're going to be for homeless people to live in. And they're going to have heat and AC and electricity. It's going to be run by the Good News Rescue Mission. It's sort of on their, they call it their campus near downtown Reading. They're calling this site Veda Street Village. And so it's basically going to be a sort of shelter site for homeless residents. And there's, you know, we have some data that in January 2023, the region had approximately 2,500 homeless people. So there is quite a need for this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how is this going to work? When are people going to be ready to move in?
Yeah. So they're going to have case management services while people are there to help them get into permanent housing. People can stay up to 10 months. So it's temporary. It's meant for sort of individuals rather than families, because the sites, the buildings are pretty small. And again, it's going to be overseen by the mission. So they'll have access to meals and showers at the mission, and, you know, porta potties on site, and all of the emissions programs. And so they had the groundbreaking this week on Tuesday, and they're going to be doing some work on the site. And then the goal is for people to be ready to move in before the end of the year.
Great. Awesome. Thank you, Jane.
Thanks.
That's it for this week's debrief. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line, which you can find on our website at ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more on our website at jeffexchange.org or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and all the other platforms.